Now I'd like to go ahead and introduce our main speaker, Josh S. from, was it Farm?
Lawndale.
I had it written wrong anyways.
Welcome. Come on up.
Josh, alcoholic, from Lawndale, and it's like Redondo Beach, only uglier than it's ever been. Anyway, my sobriety date, I celebrated a birthday this month, or last month, July 1st, was 16 years, and and so happy birthday to everyone, that's awesome, and Scott, you did a great job, man, right in the heart, so thank you. I think everyone would agree. Welcome if you're new. There's a lot of newcomers here. I hated AA when I got here. So if you're feeling that way, or if you've had like a bad run with religion, like I know what that's like too. And it's a big measure of the progress I've made as a human being walking into a church like this and not feeling anything. You know, I remember my second meeting of AA. I was 18 when I got sober, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into a church up in Palos Verdes, and I refused to walk inside of it. And my recovery house had to like talk me off the ledge. You know, I was violently anti-religious when I got to AA. So if anyone's got a problem with the idea of a judgmental God that they have a bad relationship with or grew up wrong with, I get it. That's my story. I'm really glad to see this here. It lightens things up. As someone who puts the hoe and hoe down, it feels great to be in good company. Bunch of rascals. I'm glad you're laughing. That's good. I was having some good rascally conversations before the meeting with some of the ladies of the fellowship. Thank you for that. I can see you laughing over there. I just think that I still don't know how it happened, right? I'm kind of flabbergasted, because I could tell you it's because I went to meetings. I went to 7 to 9 meetings for the first 4 years of my sobriety a week. You know, I worked the steps, and I did a thorough fourth and fifth step, and I did a couple of those, you know, and I made the amends, and I was an idiot and thought everyone made the amends, and I did it. And a lifelong rebel suddenly just followed orders. And I wish I could say it was that. I wish I could say it's because I actively sponsor guys. I wish I could say it's because I'm like a really good human being who feels empathy for other people's pain. But I honestly still don't know what it is, the miracle that stopped a guy who needed to get something in his body every single day. And if you think about that for a second, if when you were out there, like how often was it imperative? It was the main agenda of every day. It was the main agenda of every day. And it was such a main agenda that it became autonomic. The way our body breathes, our nervous system is breathing constantly and forcing our heart to beat and our cells to regenerate, etc. All these things are happening without conscious thought or will. And like, that's how drinking and using was for me. It was just part of the deal, right when you wake up. And then I came to AA, where a bunch of idiots stand around and hold hands and say a prayer, right? And I don't even like to pray, right? And I don't even like the whole religion thing when I get here. And all of a sudden, over time, I don't need to do that. It just kind of fades. It fades away. How? Right? And I don't know if you really stop to contemplate the power of that. So if you're new and you think AA is weird, you know, you're weird too. I just take a load off, you know? Take a load off and be honest with someone, if you can be. We're not here to judge you. I mean, I know I look like an idiot in this monkey suit. I still feel like an imposter whenever I put one on, right? Especially look at me from the neck up, and then you look at me from the neck down, and you're just like, what the hell is he trying to do, you know? But here I am, you know, my spot. I remember, it's going to jump all over the place. I don't have a chronological pitch. I'll talk a little bit about trauma if you want me to, you know. I can get down into the dark, dirty hole of what it's like to grow up in an alcoholic household. But anyway, my sponsor taught me to buy a suit, you know, just get a suit. I'm not a PG guy. My sponsor's a guy named Bill Cleveland, and my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Day. And we meet on Monday nights in Hermosa Beach, California, and we like to say it's where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. And we laugh. We laugh a lot. I swear I was just trying to help it over the fence, you know? Y'all come around the corner at the wrong moment. And I hope I never stay sober long enough to... there's no worse feeling in the world than taking yourself seriously. There's no worse feeling in the world than thinking everything is resting on your shoulders. And I guess I've been living that way a little bit here recently. And I'll get to that later. But let me tell you a little bit about my alcoholic household and my alcoholism. My dad was a drunk. You know, got kicked out of the Navy for selling cocaine. Entrepreneur. And then he went to med school and got kicked out for taking morphine. You know, brilliant guy. And he just kind of built up every opportunity for us as a family and then destroyed it all each time and hated himself for it. And when you hate yourself, you're not very good to other people. And then you try to be good because you're remorseful. And so this was the cycle that constantly happened and growing up, and my mom couldn't take it and she left. And when she left, I was born in Washington State. I was born in Tacoma and raised up in the Pacific Northwest. And we moved into another guy's house almost within 6 months. She met a guy. He was a youth pastor at the church. He was a tech sergeant in the Air Force at McCord up there. And he was a true blue All-American, right? Barrel chest, mustache. I mean, he could fix anything. He was from Billings, Montana. He was a cowboy. We had a 67 Chevy. And we just play nothing but, you know, Hank Williams. And we had about 150 loaded weapons in the house. I'm not even kidding. I'm not exaggerating. And this guy was so country, his middle name was Buster. And then Buster, son of Butch, right? Like Lord of the Rings. I'm Buster, son of Butch. We'd go to church every week, and four times a week, Bible studies, and then we'd come home, and when the door would shut, he'd just beat the piss out of us. And so my childhood could be summed up as Jesus and violence. And so it was, you know, there was a lot of that. And I know that there is, the reason I share about the way I'm going to share about some of this stuff is because I know that some people in here have walked in here with trauma and stuff that you grew up with. I don't think that necessarily makes me an alcoholic, although there are some interesting studies that are coming out that associate the proclivity of addictive behavior with childhood trauma in some fashion, but it's not enough or not strong enough of scientific data to delineate like firmly, right? I'm a science guy. I have applied that same mode of thinking to the spiritual way of life. I believe that there are room for both of those. I'm not one of those guys who believes you walk in Alcoholics Anonymous and lose your frontal cortex. This thing is like a heavily evolved tool that evolution gave us. It's like we're the only primate with this fully developed tool. It replaced our that's why we can't smell like other animals, right? That's how they do kin selection. They can recognize they can smell fear, they can smell their biology on other animals, etc. Like, we replaced all those tools of nature with a frontal cortex. And it's so complicated because this thing will tell me it's wrong to lie. But if I decide to lie, it'll tell me the best lie to tell. Right? So it's really complex, you know, and I don't think we lose our brain because we come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was one of those newcomers who like said, well, what about this? Well, what about that? I was one of those assholes because I know all you guys probably sponsor a couple of them. And that's who I was. And I didn't like AA. I thought AA was filled with a bunch of emotional invalids who stood around congratulating each other on their petty emotional achievements, you know? Ethel, I just got my driver's license. And it's like, well, Ethel, you're 53 years old, you know? It was about time you got your... So I was just that guy with a bad attitude sitting around saying, it's all crap, you know, AA is crap. You guys, and and it still worked for me. The miracle of love kind of still went, slipped right beneath my intellect. And I was changed from the inside out. So even if you're, I want you to, there's a thought process that dominates the new man or woman when they walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, I have to buy this hook, line, and sinker. I have to be fully committed. I have to enjoy it in order for it to work. That's not true, newcomer. That's not true. I did not like it at all. I thought it was kind of culty. I thought it was weird. It reminded me of my childhood and all that religion and violence, and I just didn't want anything to do with AA. And I thought that people didn't like practice independent thinking. And I thought that like there was just platitudes, it's answers to people's life problems. And I was mistaken, you know? I mean, that's true still sometimes, but I was mistaken. And the love of perfect strangers transformed me, slowly but surely. And there's a lot of laughter here. You know, no one in no other place will a man talk about hallucinating and holding his broken jaw open to let a snake out into the garden and have people laugh, you know? So a lot of times in my childhood, my dad would show up drunk trying to get back into my life, and Buster would try to shoot him with a .30-06. And then we'd have to stand in front of the gun and tell him to go away until my dad slunk off into the night, and then the next morning we'd be at church. Like nothing happened. So I remember when I was 8 years old, I grabbed my Bible and I threw it away. I remember standing over the trash can and dropping it in, saying, I don't have anything to do with this anymore. It doesn't work for me. I don't want anything to do with it. I don't believe it. You know, this is a travesty. And my dad came back into my life and we started to get close. We left in the dead of night one night. He knocked me unconscious for the umpteenth time. We had him incarcerated and we packed up a U-Haul and drove down and lived in the back of someone's pickup truck camper shell in their front yard that my mom knew from high school for a couple months while we were getting on our feet in San Diego. And my dad came back into my life. We kind of got close and then he died when I was 10. And right around that time, that's when I just, you know, I started smoking cigarettes behind the parking shed. I started telling the teachers where they could stick it. I progressed to running away from home and stealing and doing all that stuff, you know, just a reckless youth. I just destroyed property a lot. I was one of those kids. And my mom didn't know what to do. And so she picked me up one night and I had blue Liberty spikes in my hair at this time. And I was staying the night at some guy's house and that would later become my drug dealer. And she told me my grandpa was having a heart attack and took me in the middle of the night to this little hospital with her friend, and they were quiet the whole time, like looking at each other, and I was cussing her out and doing what I did at that time, which was just a real bad kid, you know? I had a lot of pain. And I visited that upon anyone who engaged me. And we went into this tiny little hospital and walked in through the front room, and I remember thinking, there's like no one in here if my grandpa's had a heart attack. But I thought about it for a second. We walked in the back room and the door shut and this deadbolt slid and I was in a mental institution. And so mama got cold and did what she had to do. And I stayed there for 6 months. And I was locked up, learning, cutting on myself, hanging out with all the schizophrenics and just learning about drinking. That's what I was learning about. And when I was there, I tried hanging myself for the first time. I got transferred to a medium security residential treatment center. And I got moved after a couple months over to the ward where I could have shoes when we went out in the recess. And I took the shoelaces off those shoes and I put it around my neck and put it against the hinges of a solid core door in my bathroom. And just, I was done at 12. And I lost my nerve, obviously, and came to with a welt on my neck. And I didn't feel that kind of peace again until I had my first drink. So drinking did something for me as an alcoholic that it didn't do for the average temperate person. It suspended my fear. And it suspended my comparison tool I have up here, where constantly I'm measuring other people and myself. I'm either better or I'm worse. Constantly. I'm either better or I'm worse. I never say, me and him are on the same level. You know? It's one or the other. And drinking, I remember I got out of there and that's where they told me what was wrong with me. I got to take this off. It's kind of crispy in here.
I'm sweating like a newcomer right now. Sorry, church. lightning right through the roof, just down into my spine. But that's where they told me, you know, I had PTSD from my childhood and bipolar and all this, and they put me on a bunch of medication. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on all that medication. You know, I was on it for over a decade. Heavy antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, sleeping pills, so because it screws up your brain chemistry, so they got to give you a little bit of trazodone to bring you down at night. And I haven't been on medication in AA since I was 22. And I'm not sharing that story to tell you that you can get off medication in AA and should. I'm sharing that story because that's my story. And because I am a guy who came in on medication, I feel uniquely qualified to say that no one in Alcoholics Anonymous should be given advice on that. No one. And I want to also say that I understand why you would. I understand why you would. Like, I get it. We think that the new, when you're new and you come into AA, you're kind of out of your mind. And incredibly, you have a skewed perception, just like any normal human being with a limited experience would, you know? It's a completely valid perception from where you come from, but it is not necessarily the big picture, right? And so we, as people in Alcoholics Anonymous, think, well, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's probably, or she is probably abusing this medication in a way to try to live, or whatever we think. And then we think we got to tell him to get off that shit and like really start living it and feel it, you know, feel it, get inside. And I know your heart's in the right place, but I'm telling you that that stuff comes out in the wash on its own. It comes out in the wash on its own. My story was I got off meds and haven't been on them. And I am still a depressive. I do have a different brain chemistry. I'm a creative. I like writing. I like making music. I do all this stuff. But I'm a creative, and I'm also happen to be a depressive. And so sometimes it just hits me on a chemical level. And I've had to form a new relationship with it. And I understand that this is my brain chemistry. I get this. This is what's happening right now is I'm having a hard time. The dopamine levels in my, it's not plugging into the receptor. You know, we've got a low amount of chemical that allows this emotion to sprout into my experience. And that helps me, you know, meditation helps me, service to other people helps me, but it still happens. And that's just that's what I get to deal with, you know. And so if you're dealing with anything, people in Alcoholics Anonymous get anxiety, they get depression, they get all sorts of shit. And I just want to let you know, if you got time sober and you're struggling, like, you got to talk to someone about that. No one really believes you have it all together. Not a single one of you. I certainly do not have it all together, right? I'm just a human becoming like the rest of you guys. And I learn more about myself each day. And I do not have the answer. I do not have the answer. But maybe the answer is to stop having so many goddamn questions. Right? So I started drinking at 12. And I'm going to speed through it. I broke a lot of bones when I was drinking. I got kicked out of every high school I ever attended. The educational system abandoned me at the beginning of 11th grade, you know. And I thought I could read because I'm smarter than anyone anyway. And so I ended up going back to the same mental institution as an adult that I went to as a child at like 18 years old. And so Carlos would come pick me up with the white van every morning. And my mom was just proud. Of me going off with the schizophrenics to go do my dual diagnosis program instead of going to junior college like Tony's kids, right? Her best friend from high school. And I was playing in a black metal band that then turned into a solo project because I was too much of an a-hole to deal with anyone else. And I was taking pictures in the woods with my shirt off with a 50-inch sword of Odin and an 80-inch battle axe. And I was writing in code. I had my own alphabet. I was studying demonology. I was writing a manifesto. And I thought that I was the incarnation of a Viking warlord, should have been born 1,000 years ago. And so I might have done meth once, you know. For 2 years. And I would just sit in my room and watch Braveheart over and over and over again and drink Steel Reserve and just think to myself and cry when William Wallace gave his speech and think to myself, there's just no honor in the world anymore. And so, you know, I was just out of my mind when I came to AA. I had really long black hair, and I had, they made me take the four piercings in my face I had. I had upside down crosses and pentagrams carved into me, cigarettes put out all over my forearms. Just looking at people, all in black, combat boots, six chains down to my ankle, like I wanted to eat them. And I was not a happy guy when I got to AA. I was not happy. And I got sent to New Life House. And New Life House was like filled with these Stepford Wives, simulacrum creatures that would just say the same stuff to each other and hold each other accountable. And they came to the AA mothership meeting and everyone said the same stuff too. And I was just sitting there like, I see through this, people. I see through what you're doing. And I see all the hierarchy, right? This is just like a tribe of chimpanzees on a larger level, and I'm going to penetrate the meaning of all this bullshit. And so that guy, the guy, is a hard guy to talk to at an AA. And I remember being there in my very first meeting in Chinatown and on Monday night, and me and another newcomer that I found, because water always seeks its own level. And we were just talking about how crappy AA was, you know? He's like, man, this is crap. I'm like, I know, look at all these stupid people. Does it the stupid, do you hear what he said? It's ridiculous. And then at the very end of the meeting, he's like, all right, man, see you next week. I'm like, yeah, see you next week. So, I'm telling you that the universe is so compassionate that total knuckleheads can get this thing. And even really strong-willed or people who are, I'm an intellectual guy, I can't help it, I just think a lot. It's adrenalized, it just happens, you know, and I can't let it go. I haven't been able to yet. Through deep levels of meditation, through complete self-surrender and the renunciate path, you know, I'm up to the point, but right before, sprinkling ashes on my own food to deny myself a taste, right? I mean, like, just, I have attempted to abandon it. And here it stays, right? Here it stays. And so, like, the first 5 years of my sobriety, I went to that house, and about 1 year sober, they were screaming, like, miracle, miracle, during my first year cake. You know, and happy birthday to the 1 year. It's a big deal, brother. Yeah, it's a big deal. First year's for you, next year for everyone else. And is what they told me. And I said, what a prick, you know? So hopefully you don't think that. You know, but if you do, my feelings are hurt. But the first 5 years after that happened, what I realized through all of the fighting, watching everyone else get better because I didn't want to change my whole first year, something I just thought, man, maybe I can do it. Maybe I can do AA. I hit my bottom in sobriety. Well after I was already coming to the meetings, and well after I was doing the three-step shuffle with sponsors. One, two, three, bye! And they finally placed me with a guy who was like the antithesis, right? This jock from Poway. And I'm like this little musician kid, right? Who's like, I read, you know? I can tell you about the ancient Egyptians. You know anything about the ancient Egyptians? Yeah, I'm sure you could, too common, but you don't know anything about staying sober, right? You don't know, so shut up. We don't care about the ancient Egyptians. And that's kind of how I was. I would sit there ranting, smoking cigarettes, like three packs a day, you know? Like, all of you, you don't know anything. You don't think. You don't care. And all the guys in my recovery house would make fun of me and say, oh, I used another big word. like that's just kind of how it always went. But around a year is when I kind of thought, well, maybe I did like helping people. I liked sitting down and just talking with a dude and making him laugh and just lightening things up. And that's what I'd done my whole life to hide. And I found that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it became a kind of gift to just make people giggle. Be a rascal. And I like it, you know? I like helping people. I like letting people know that the train hasn't left the station. You're not screwed. You're not nearly as screwed as you think you are. You're in the hands of something, whatever it is. And there's a flow here. There's healing that takes place here. on a profound level. And it's touched me, right? And the thing to think about that we all take for granted is up until the 70s, they were still given alcoholics. There was still a case of alcoholics getting transorbital lobotomies to stop them from drinking. And all of a sudden, you come here and hold hands and say a stupid prayer and live in a community and face some of your shortcomings and write down where you were to blame and some of the people you hate and go and apologize and pay the money back. And all of a sudden, you're sponsoring other people and you're sober for some reason and the impulse to drink is arrested one day at a time. Weird. It's so stupid. It doesn't make any sense. It's so illogical. But something happens here. You know, and that started to happen for me. And so I left that sober living on bad terms about when I graduated. And then they saw how uncivilized I still was. And they revoked my graduation and told me to stay in the house longer. And I'm like, I don't think you understand how I've dealt with authority my entire life. No, thank you. Go, boop, you know. And then I had made friends in AA and I stepped into AA. And I fell in line with a group of people that really knew how to work the steps. Right? You know those people? You really know how to work the steps. And so I became one of those people. And it saved me for a minute. I needed, I guess, some structure in my life. But what quickly began to happen through that process, it started, you know, at 2 years sober, I want to let you know who's talking to you. I stole the entire treasury for the Wednesday night speakers meeting. The entire thing. I spent it on adult entertainment and cigars for me and my friends. Okay? And then I had to go make amends for it. And I thought I'd gotten away with it. I thought I was like, what? And it wasn't even like I thought I got away with it. It's like I literally thought I paid it back just because it was flush when I gave it back to him. And I made fake donations. And I knew everyone at AA would never ask what the amounts were. I said, I made it according to the Seven Tradition pamphlet. Please see me after the meeting if you'd like to know the exact amounts. And of course, everyone's so self-centered, no one asked. And I thought I was scot-free. And I was okay with that because that was the level of consciousness I was living at. To me, from where I came from to that, that was me doing the right thing. I was actually patting myself on the back, you know? Like, you paid it back. What a good guy. Jeez, you changed. And so I remember then Matthew M., this guy from my home group, he was speaking at that same Wednesday night speakers meeting. He was like, we pay back all the money in AA. We pay back all the money. And I was like, yeah, hell yeah, we do. You know? And then the next day I was at work sweeping and I heard his voice like a raven flap across my mind, you know? We pay back all the money. And I'm like, you know? And I realized I hadn't. And so I had to do that. I had to stand in front of the whole meeting and give him all the money back and say, I stole all your money. You know, is there anything I can do to make it right? And they said, clean up after the meeting. And so I cleaned up after the meeting and I was scot-free, baby. It was, I've had all sorts of amends. I've had amends I didn't even know I owed. I remember when I was 7 years sober, I was standing in front of a bar with my friends my childhood friends I'd known since second grade. We've fallen out of touch kind of since, but I knew these guys a long time. And so I met him at the bar, and then this kid named Chris, that man, I didn't remember how mean I was to this kid. I was a bully. I was that kid who got beat. And so he beat on other people. And I didn't remember how cruel I was to this kid growing up. And he was the bartender at this place. And so he comes up. And to me, I'm 7 years into this new way of life. I'm not even thinking on the level that guy used to think on. And I'm like, Chris, what's up, man? And he's like, what's up? And then he like tries to fight me at the bar. And I'm sitting there and he's talking trash. And he's, you know, and I'm sitting there and there's a group of guys now. And now we're in the tribal situation that all men recognize, where you're in a circle with men and they're all looking at you and you need to assert dominance quickly. And I'm thinking, all right, I think I can take this guy easily. And I'm going to, and what comes out of my mouth is I'm assessing whether I'm going to have to put him down to save my pride at 7 years sober is, dude, you're right. I was a piece of junk to you. I never had the right to treat you that way. I didn't even remember it, man. I don't know if you know this, but I don't drink anymore. You know, I live a different way now. I'm not the same guy I used to be, but I can understand why you're upset. And if there's anything, do you mind if we talk, you know? Is there anything I can do? And we sat and we talked. And I said, is there anything I can do to make it right? And he said, yeah, have a shot with me. And I'm like, Chris, I don't think you were listening, man. I can't have a shot with you. He said, well, have a shot of Coke then. And I said, I can do a shot of Coke. So he lined it up on the bar and he poured me a shot of Coke and we had a shot of Coke together. And, you know, it's like AA starts to work sometimes. This way of life will infect you, so you start to do a different thing. And that's what is being described in the spiritual experience in the book, where Roland Hazard was talking to Dr. Jung, right? And Jung was saying that they're, look, I've been trying to change your mind at a deeper level. I've been trying to give you this, what William James called the religious experience. I'm trying to, and what the religious experience or the spiritual awakening that's in our 12 steps, what we talk about, what it is this inner set of motivations and this emotional nature, the way I normally react to things, right? The book is peppered with it. Uncommon sense will become common sense, right? Like, there's something that starts to dominate me where in those situations I change. Like when I had 90 days sober and my mom, who was an undiagnosed Al-Anon, got yelled at by the recovery house for being too clingy and in my business. And she called me up and said, you can come home. And I said, and I hated this place. I hated it. I said, yeah, I think I'm going to stay. And I didn't want to stay. I don't even know what happened, you know? I don't even know what happened still to this day. But I'm real glad it did. I'm real glad it did. And so let me jump forward with all those thoughts and all that stuff. You know, I was really working the steps. And around 4 years sober, my girlfriend drank. I was in a sick codependent relationship with a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taking her to meetings and watching her and watching the speaker and watching her and watching the speaker to make sure that there was some sort of glint of recognition in her eyes, right? Because if she doesn't get better, I can't get laid, right? Like, basically. And so it was this screwed up, completely screwed up situation. And my sponsor at the time, who was really up in my business, we would fight all the time. There was a lot of yelling. There was a lot of thumb pushing. There was all the, you know, finger in the chest. And I had a falling out, like a big falling out. And I remember going to Bill Cleveland's house that night. I was crying. I didn't know what to do. I was just trying to get relief. I was sad. I'm sad. I had 4.5 years sober. I've made the amends. I've paid back the money. I was sponsoring the world. All the old timers, in my opinion, were a little too lazy saying easy does it. And I was ripping out car keys out of the wet drunk's hands and putting them on my couch with orange juice and honey and reading the big book at them, you know? Confess! That's how it felt. And so my spiritual ego grew so large it crushed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always needed to have the answer. You know, I couldn't compliment other people and tell them what a good job they were doing because I felt that reduced me somehow. I was just living in ego, so much ego. And I cried in Bill's basement. It was like 10 over after 10 o'clock at night. And I just looked down and said, dude, I don't know what to do. And he held me. This big man, if you've ever met Bill C., he just held me and let me cry. And he said, Josh, you're one of the good guys. You're okay the way you are. You're okay. He just kept saying that. You're okay. You're okay. You're okay the way you are. And it slipped beneath my mind. It went right into my heart. And I really believe that's where the profound shift in Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me. 4 years in. So if you're waiting around and still kicking the tires and kind of upset sometimes and still unsure and still lurking notions and all that stuff, mine followed me for 4 years in AA. Being a newcomer running around, being a young person in AA, trying to sleep with anything I could and drink energy drinks and gamble late into the night, right? Like just sensation, sensation, sensation. Like give me something, give me something. And I think that's where it really happened for me. It began, and after that point, up until that point, all of AA had been an additive process. It was giving me things that I didn't have. That's what I thought. And at that point, I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps was a subtractive process. In the first step, I was losing power, and I was losing the need to manage the results of my life. And in the second step, I was losing the need to solve my own problem, right? And in the third step, the way I like to think about my will and my life is my will is my what I want, my ambition, aka my future. My will I'm exerting right now so I can get something, right? So it's my future. And my life is what I have. It's my experience. It's my past. So I like to think of the third step as turning my past and my future over to the power so that I can live in the moment, which is all there is. Past is memory. Future is imagination. It's all here. So And in the fourth step, I lost the story I had where I was convinced it was everyone else's fault. I didn't think I had a part to play, even in my stepfather, who beat the shit out of me. I had a part to play in that because I used that pain to hurt other people. It was my justification tool. And at the very least, I wasn't forgiven, right? Poor Buster, he just had a hammer in his tool belt, in his toolbox, right? Everything was a nail, including me. And my father, you know, my father just suffered from alcoholism. That's what he died of. When I was in that mental institution, when I found out, he died with a 0.36 blood alcohol level. Walking across the foggy Washington road, and he was struck by a car. And so there was so much pain in me and so much, like, all this stuff. And I started to see that what I thought I was missing was actually already there. It was just blocked off by all the untruth I'd learned along the way. And that's what Bill helped awaken in me when he sat me down and looked me in the eye and told me I was okay the way I was. The guy who, like, every mental institution I've ever been to, every therapist I ever saw, by the time I got to AA, I had 3 psychiatric evaluations, right? They're like 600 questions long, they're intense. They kept on trying to figure out what was wrong with me. And doing a couple of stupid things, saying a couple of stupid prayers, trusting a couple of stupid people, like, in my opinion at that time, transformed my life. And in the fifth step, I lost one brick in the wall of I'm never going to tell a soul, right? And in the sixth and seventh step, all the stuff that helps us survive while we're drinking and using is now a liability in this place where community will heal us. And community can heal us, you know, and I think that's what it is, belonging, sense, purpose. Purpose is more important than happiness, newcomer. I know some of us are waiting around to be happy forever, but it is literally a biochemical reaction. It's a dopamine plug-in in your receptor site. It's like very temporary, only a limited supply. So sorry to inform you. And so it's very important to have something purposeful, right? Nietzsche said that a man who has a why can suffer almost any how, right? So if I know what I'm doing here and I know why it means something, then stuff can happen. And stuff has happened. 8 and 9, all the reasons I have for imploding my relationships and continuing to hate myself, I've gone back and I've made restitution. Start to be able to look the world in the eye a little bit. Because I know that, man, if you own who you are, no one can ever use it against you. You're sitting in here, some people, everyone's got stuff we hide it. I want to hide my addiction to sex. I like sex a lot. You know, like, and I love it, and I am some, and it has played me out of pocket at several phases of my sobriety. But here it is; it's still there. I'm a rascal. I like bending the rules. I still like doing that. I like going and being asked to speak somewhere and not parking in the speaker spot, so I'm watching everyone get nervous from a distance. I still like to shake up the fishbowl, you know, and I hope that never goes away. I hope it never goes away, that I get too pious and I get too much time and I know too many people respect me now. And I need to make, like, I just want you to know that you can be who you are in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the center of it is infinite. It's huge. It's inclusive. The ecology, you guys are a natural ecosystem. When's the last time you went into the woods hiking somewhere beautiful, right? And you looked and said, or go to the beach and say, that's an ugly tree. It looks out of place. That bush shouldn't have grown that way. That wave shouldn't have broke that way. Right? Like, unless you're a surfer. And I understand that at that time, you're like, kind of like, dude, there's no break. This is crap. It's glad. It's mushy. It's soft. And I'm like, but like, everything belongs. We need the guy who hits on all the newcomer girls so we can have the guy who holds that guy accountable, right? Like, and feels purposeful that way. We need the one person who controls every facet of the meeting so we can have the other person who's like, oh, that, there he goes again, you know? Like, we need the one person to share, and we get worried. You think, oh God, they're sharing about Jesus. That person in AA who always says, you know, and my power I choose to call Jesus Christ. And you go, oh, I hope the newcomer is not going to leave, right? Because they were beaten, like molested by a priest or something, you know? And you're like, you're not sensitive to that. We're so driven by our subjective experience in which we are the hero that we think everyone needs to hear it. Like us. Because of this subjectivity that we've been given in this world, in this life, that it's the right way, you know? And I'm that experience I had in Bill's basement started to open my mind You know, and the 11th step was huge. The 10th step is a condensation. I continue to be aware. Why am I doing this? Why do I say that? I was at this mail thing. I was a part of this situation, and we did an interactive mail experience to try to give purpose to men. And we did a film, and I helped write that film, and we had about 70 guys there kind of confronting their inner, I'm not going to take responsibility for my life, right? A lot of this, we think there's an epidemic and a high suicide rate in America and all this stuff, and so it's something I got to be a part of. And I was sitting next to a priest, and they said, go to someone you would never talk to, and I went to the priest. and me and this priest were talking, and I still felt inclined to say, like, you know, out loud when we were all talking, I'm not a Christian. I am not a Christian, and I don't think I'll ever be a Christian. There's still something in me that wants to fight. And so it's there still. But that's the 10th step, is acknowledging, there it is. It hasn't left. Not, there it is, you piece of junk. Why do you always do this? Why can't you be better? Why can't you be like when you share? You know, why can't you be more spiritual? No, no. Spirituality is making room for what's there. Spirituality is setting a place at the table for everything within you to sit at it and eat and take nourishment. It is not about excluding the ugly pieces that fall short. It is about bringing them into the huddle and saying, let's try a little harder next time. I love you anyway. It is about looking at the things that you think that shouldn't be there and making room for them. And so I make room for my rascal. And I love him, you know. When I was leading a men's retreat out in Hawaii, and all the natives, the indigenous guys were there, and they have a part of their mythology. And they, when I came back in, they wrote it on the whiteboard, and it was Wahakali Kanake Kalohe O. Shit. And this is on a CD too. So God, I'm sorry, listen. Listen to this asshole up here. Waha Kanaka Kalohe O. I think. It means the one who is a rascal. Right? It's a part of their mythology. And like, that's who I am. I am still a rascal. And Alan Watts talks about the irreducible element of rascality. It's the salt in the human stew. You know what makes stew taste so good, human beings? It's the salt. If I want to be a spiritual being, it's hard to also have a human experience. There is a place for both, and there's only a place for both when I can make room for both, right? And so that's where I don't want to be so heavenly minded that I'm of no earthly good, right? And so I've done the whole song and dance where you're in AA trying to pretend to be righteous. And I'm telling you that the people who are the most righteous in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes hide the darkest secrets. And I say that as someone who was once very righteous in Alcoholics Anonymous and in the world in general. It is such a high bar to hold oneself to. You feel like you get to a point where you cannot make mistakes because everyone's looking. And it's a lonely place to be. And so if you're feeling that way or you are that way, I just want to invite you to just be okay with not being perfect. You know, because that is the level of perfection in itself, to make room for all that's there. The same way you go into a wildlife reserve and no one's pruning it. Some of these places out in the world, no one is taking care of it. It's taking care of itself. And sometimes lightning strikes and sometimes fires burn. Those fires regenerate the soil. It is a ecology that's self-correcting. And so I guess in my 10th year, it became kind of living in two places. Right? Like, what? I am powerless, and yet I've accessed power. Now, which is it? Is it powerless, or is it now accessing power? Right? There became a certain time in my sobriety where living powerlessly was disempowering. Right? And all of a sudden, I realized that I could go ahead and sit in the closet and pray for a ham sandwich. But faith without works was dead. And I started to think of, if I know my friend Ralph White likes to say that the spiritual tools are power tools. They plug in. And once I've plugged in my power tools, what the hell am I going to build with them? And that's what my 10th year of sobriety became about, is living in both places, knowing that of myself I am nothing, the Father doeth the works, right? But trying to get to work anyway. and trying to see what I can do to build. Do I start a business? I did. The business failed at 10 years sober. I was in real estate. I lost my whole life savings. Big six figures plus some, went into debt on the brink of bankruptcy. Someone came because this universe is self-correcting. Someone I didn't ask stepped into my life and said, hey man, I see what you're doing and going through, and like, we can, what can you afford? Every single time, if you look back in your life, I feel like there's been something that's delivered. And when the thing that I thought was going to make me happy fell out of my life, I realized at the end of that there was something even better waiting on the other side of it. It always self-corrects. I'm just so convinced that the universe is bountiful by nature, that it gives. And sometimes there's, and I ran into a situation, and this is, I got to shut up like now, but I ran into a situation, I'll leave you with this, and I probably shouldn't, it's irresponsible, but so, there came a time in my sobriety where morality no longer fit. Right, wrong, good, evil, the left path, the right path, this binary mode of thinking. If you think about it, look at the human brain, right? I'm a left-center politic guy or a right-center politic guy. It's good or it's evil. It's night or it's day. It's light or it's dark. There's this bisection. There's this binary thought, one or the other, either or, either or, either or. And I ran into situations where good people died and some people got cancer and lots of people lost their money and all this stuff was happening, and my idea of a moral God broke apart. Because if God was moral, and if this was moral, and it all seemed to emanate from a system of rules that came from human mind, right? And that's how the universe operates. When a planet destroys itself, it was a bad planet, right? Like, that perhaps there was a place in which all things could be as they are. And that my thought of right or wrong, good or bad, light or darkness, was a projection. And that there is a place for everyone to exist in the center. And that center is filled with love. And that center self-corrects. And that works for me better now. Thanks.